But that's the kind of rub that the use of the word trigger gives me. It almost makes me feel like, oh, poor you, passive. You know, you're just so passive. You know, some lady walks by and you go, oh, I'm triggered. Or you say something and you go, oh, I'm triggered. It's almost like an alcoholic blaming everyone for pouring alcohol down their throat and making them drunk. And it's just to me, it's like I can't think that way. I know it happens, you know, but I can't think that way about myself. I have to realize that whenever I lust, I'm making a choice to lust. Even if I'm a powerless addict, I'm making the choice. Maybe I have to make the choice. That's debatable. I don't know. But I'm definitely powerless over lust when I start to use lust. Whenever I agree intentionally to use lust, even for, there's no 3-second rule. Immediately, as soon as I decide, whoa, I'm going to use that, then I'm powerless over lust. And I'm more powerless now than I was before. In my case, I feel I'm more powerless now than before I started the program. My level of powerlessness is not less than it was before I started the program. It's more. I'm more powerless because if I intentionally use lust, my tolerance to it is very, very little. And I feel the insanity very quickly, and I cannot tolerate it. So I have to either get out of that, get away from the lust quickly, or I'm afraid I'm, you know, going to lose everything I've got. Doesn't mean that I walk around feeling like I'm in more danger than before I started the program. I'm in less danger because it's sort of like a person with diabetes, they say, loses sensation in their feet sometimes. They get numbness in the feet. They'll forget car keys in their shoe and they won't know about it until they feel like this. They're not walking right. They take off their shoe and out comes the car keys, you know? And it's like terrible stuff happens. They get cuts and they don't know it. Having a lack of sensation is a horrible, horrible problem. People get cuts and they don't even know. You know why blood is red? So that you notice it when you bleed. If it was clear, we would be bleeding and we wouldn't even know it sometimes. You know, God is good. So the lack of sensation is really a horrible thing. And a person gets really far into things before they even know it. And that's what happens to me as an addict. And the further along I go, with God's help, in recovery, the more sensitive I am, and the more like a normal person I become, where if I have a little rock in my shoe, it drives me crazy, and I cannot keep walking. I have to say, I don't care who I'm walking with. You know, I can be walking with, you know, Rosh HaMemshala or whatever, I don't know. I have to say, excuse me, I have to take off my shoe, get the rock out, and then I can keep walking with you. I can't tolerate it. Yet before, I didn't even feel it. You know, I was all, you know, orangutan, you know? I don't know how to translate that in Hebrew. I was all, you know, mixed up and focused on lusting, and I didn't know. I thought I was focused on struggling with lust, you know, or staying sober. I thought that was what I was focused on. I wasn't focused on staying sober. I was focused on lust. It doesn't matter if I'm focused on running away from lust or if I'm focused on lusting. I think the Kutsky used to say, if you wrestle with a muddy guy, you're going to get covered with mud. So, you know, who won the fight? You know, you're gross, you know? So that's the program. It's like a whole different perspective for me. And talking about this is triggering, that's triggering, it engenders this whole passive, I'm being controlled by my environment way of thinking. And it's like, forget it. If I do that, I'm not even getting started. In the same way, if I'm driving with my wife, and every single thing she says to me makes me crazy, you know? I mean, so then I'm constantly triggered, you know? Oh, you're going too fast, you're going too slow. Look out for that guy, look out for that guy. We have to make a right turn, don't forget. I'm like, ah! You know? And does she love me? Yeah. Does she, is she trying to make me, is she trying to cut me down? No. It's just that's the way that it feels. It's triggering for me, you know? So if I can go through a trip with her, and I'm just using this as the trip. The driving car is just an example for like living in any circumstances. It's all the same for me. If every single thing she says is a big stinking deal, and I have to kind of fight it and work my fourth step and then surrender and then make a phone call in my head to somebody and admit the truth and then think to myself, do I really give up this pride? Because I know it's pride. Okay, I'm ready. Now we do step 7. God, please, Tata, take away my pride. I cannot handle pride at all, obviously. Thank you very much. By that time, you know, I don't know where we're going to be. We might be, you know, halfway into, you know, past the green line, you know, or something. We're going to be completely lost. I don't have time for that. I have to have some kind of mechanism where I don't see every single thing as a trigger. I'm focused on something else. What am I focused on? So here's the choice. My friends, I have a lot of friends who are like thinking, am I an addict? Am I not an addict? Oy vey, am I doing tshuva? Am I not doing tshuva? And that's their whole struggle. So they're going to think, they usually say, quick, I have to run and distract myself from this problem. That's the eitzah, distract myself. And in the program, I hear people say, no, you have to engage with life, right? That's what I keep hearing, engage with life. So that talk the other day, I talked about how once I was lusting at work, and I felt really crazy, and I knew I had to make a phone call, so I figured, call my sponsor, it's my knee-jerk reaction. He wasn't available, I figured, call my wife. What am I going to call my wife and tell her that I'm lusting at work? No. I'm going to call, we'll get to that issue later, because that's a big one. But I'm going to call my wife. It didn't occur to me to call my wife and tell her, oh, you know, save me from my lust, you know. I went to call my wife to ask her, so was Tutzach, you know, what's going on at home, how are the kids? Connecting with real life eliminates, for me, the lust, because the lust is living in fantasy, crazy drama. You have a little dose of normal, a teaspoon of normal. Oh, and like there's this shift in me, and the lusting is no longer working on me. I'm not running away from the lust. I'm engaging in real life, and the reaction is supposed to be: here I am at work. You know, the most important thing right now is whether I look at this dirty magazine that this guy has on his desk, let's say, and then I make a phone call to my uncle, my brother, my this, my that. Nothing about program. Connect with them really. Oh, I'm sorry. Connect with them really, and then the reaction is supposed to be, oh, where was I? All right, I have paperwork to do, you know? Not lust or paperwork, you know, but, oh, real life is happening and going by. Let me engage in real life. Because 99.9% of the time, I don't have completely unstructured time, you know? It's very rare. Totally unstructured time with nothing to do. That's really very rare, and the longer I go in the program, the more I realize, I hear my kids always saying, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored. I am never bored, you know? I don't know if that's a function of being old, or if that's a function of recovery or what, but I always have something to do. In the old days, I don't like talking in past tense, but 20 years ago, I might have had 20 things to do, but I have this whole world of sexual and schmutzy options waiting there for me that I can plug into at all times. So it was doche, whatever else I had to do, you know? Because who needs this drudgery if I have all that excitement? Okay, I'm going to feel like a piece of garbage after that excitement. I'm going to ruin my relationships with my wife, my children, everybody that I know, and even the Jewish community, because then I walk out of the house, you know, woo, the tzitzis are flying, and I'm a big fake. You know, I ruin my relationship with everybody. So, okay, but now that's not an option. You know, I mean, I want to engage in real life. I want real life. Rav Noach Weinberg, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, I loved him very much, and he used to say, if you need to go to movies in order to get excitement in life, then your life is way too boring. You're not discovering the excitement in your own life. There's something wrong in this picture. And that struck me. I should make a movie about it. So before I go on and on, I wrote a bunch of stuff down. Some of it I wrote on the plane. Everybody here is holding in a different place. What would really be great is if, you know, for my ego, is if I could be like a therapist, you know, a super therapist, and then ask each couple, you know, each person, you know, what's your issue, what's your issue, what's your issue, and then like the guy that plays chess with 14 people at the same time, you know, go from table to table to table, like that would be really, really great. Wow, I'm awesome. But I can't do that, obviously. So the thing to do is for me to just spew a bunch of stuff from my experience that's true, and hopefully what's true is gonna be heard, and it'll be done in a way that with God's help, it'll be useful to those who it's useful for, and for you who it doesn't apply to at all because you're holding in a whole different place, you know, okay. But I want to have some time where people are able to obviously share, and that's a main part of this thing, so I don't want to talk forever. I want to get through a couple of things. Just a few notes I wanted to share before I forget. A lot of people here are holding way past a lot of things that I'm going to say, and a lot of people can't even see it yet coming down the road. So I don't know. I think I've met a lot of guys who tell the truth to their spouses, let's say, or vice versa. I'm going to keep using guys as the sexaholic and the woman as the Essanon over and over and over. And I apologize for those who hear it's not that way. But that's just what I'm so used to from my experience so far. So I'll keep going back to that accidentally. A lot of guys who say, well, I came clean with my wife, but it's obvious that they haven't come clean with anybody else. You know, maybe a shrink, maybe, but that's it. They can't go to meetings, or they're very uncomfortable opening up in meetings, hard to open up about all the truth with their sponsors, that kind of thing. And that's the kind of thing is going on. And while most people here are not holding in that situation, probably, I just want to share one thing about why I think that happens, and I think for me it was quite enlightening. I think that when we're willing to tell our spouse, only our spouse, about what's going on and not other people who could really help us because they're not dependent on us, the reason for that is because I know that if I were to use my wife as my honesty person, I'm safe. Because my shame is her shame. She's not telling anybody. You know, now some of you might not be in that situation. But my wife was, you know, she'd rather die than the neighborhood finding out about my problem. You know, her friends finding out about my problem. Her parents finding out about my problem. We agreed to tell my parents about my problem. But she still hasn't told her parents. You know, and I've told her a number of times it's okay if you tell Ima and Abba, it's okay with me. Why is she better? Why is she not okay? Because it's embarrassing. You know, here you married this guy, we thought he was a great guy, and you obviously goofed. It's embarrassing to her. She feels like a jerk, and it's bad enough that I lied to her for all these years. Now other people have to find out that she's married to somebody. You know, that she chose, that she picked me. You know. Oh, I thought Dov was such a great guy, and you know. So that's just the perspective, you know, and it's painful for me to think that way, but I realize that that's what's going on. I know that she's safer, because my shame is, I'm putting my shame on her. She feels ashamed. Her secret is safe. My secret is safe with her. That's the only reason I'm telling her. Not because she's going to help me. Guys go to their wives for help. A lot of times it's not because they think their wives are going to help. It's because they have to tell somebody and they just can't bear to tell anybody who might, you know, not be safe. And they think their wives are the only safe person. I just think that's something to put out there. The other big, big, big deal that I just wanted to mention before, which is bigger than anything I can say in like a short time, it's got lots of tentacles, is shayach to what I was saying before about getting busy with living instead of fighting lust. The program talks about surrender, surrender, surrender versus white knuckle sobriety. And it sounds like a nice, you know, concept, but it really has a lot of corollaries. And one of them is that sobriety is about, you know, keep my hands to myself or whatever. A very limited issue, sobriety. Recovery is about, to me, is about letting sex and well, not lust really, but sex in particular, and well, certainly lust, you know, let's call lust as relevant to life as like a broken leg, you know. So keeping broken legs should not be an issue in my life. I shouldn't be thinking about, don't break your leg, oy vey, that'll hurt. You know, you might need screws and a you know, fixation and hospitalization, and that's how a person walks around all day, you know. So, I mean, yeah, maybe if he broke his legs 20 times before, but that's no way to live, you know. So keeping my own business, my main business, is what recovery is all about to me. And if you look in step 12, in the 12 and 12, which I mentioned last time I spoke, like that's the big thing that Bill and company talk about. And in relationships, that translates to not making her business my business. Just like as a sexaholic walking down the street, my normal derech is, whoa, there goes somebody, yeah, let me follow her into the supermarket. You know, she looks like this and that, and then I have to call my sponsor. Why is her business my business? She's going into the supermarket to buy da-da-da-da-da. She's not trying to attract me. What's the matter with me? But I translate, this is fantasy, kicks in. And it's almost like, oh, we have a connection, you know? It's crazy. But that's what happens. I'm so used to fighting and running from lust, I'm making something that's really irrelevant to me my business. If I tell my wife about it, let's say, the mushel, the most understanding person, she'll say to me, what are you doing? You went to the grocery store to buy, you know, apples, potatoes, this and this. I don't see pretty girls on here. You know, they're not on the list. Well, like, what are you doing? You know, she doesn't understand, like, oh, you don't understand. This is an adventure. This is my God just walked into the room, you know? I call it, it's a cute thing, heroin dependence, but with an E at the end of the word heroin. You know, it's she's going to save me. You don't understand. You know, and she's like, number one, she's not going to save you. Number one, I'm supposed to save you. You know, we don't have a very healthy relationship, do we? You know, but that's what she feels like. You should be running to me. No, you know. Ooh, thank God, my wife, who never went to Essanon, really, you know, as a member, she went to see what's doing meetings a few times, but she didn't need that. She never felt, for some reason, that she was supposed to save me. But in a lot of relationships, that's really the way it is. The porn is so hurtful because you're supposed to be worshiping me, I think, I'm guessing. And in my situation, it's not that. It hasn't been that way. And I'm lucky. What's my business? What's your business? You know? That's something, that boundary is a killer for many people. I know. I'm supposed to make life my main occupation, and it's really a 24-hour occupation, real life, the life that I'm living. So we talk about in the third step, put my life and my will into the care of God. Well, my life and my will is very small area when I start recovery, you know? It's basically acting out or not acting out, you know? That's pathetic. Life is really about pretty much everything else than that, and by the time the average guy that I know crawls into SA, that's almost all their life. And they're putting their acting out in God's hands. No wonder they're saying that steps one is about I can't act out, step two is God can help me stop acting out, and step three is God save me from acting out. And that's not what it's about. It's my will and my life. That encompasses Torah and mitzvah, whatever you choose your life to be. Marriage, you relate your children, whatever, your job, you know, your parents, your friends, your community. It's this giant, giant thing, and they shrink the program down into steps 1, 2, and 3 are about lusting or not acting out or not acting out. It's so very sad. Chovas Alvava says this beautiful mashal. He says that kafui tova means, in English, it means you're an ingrate. So he says kafui means that you roll something up into a very small roll, I think. Maybe that's like a Hebrew word or something. But it's the idea that you have this big thing and instead of all this gratitude for all this great stuff that you got, You roll it up into a thing and you say, oh, you gave me this. That's all you gave me. There's no expanse in the appreciation of the scope of real life. It's narrowed down into one small area. That's so tragic. And when it happens in a relationship, can you imagine? I mean, my wife, people talk about, oh, isn't sex supposed to be perfect after you're in recovery for 10 years? Maybe yeah, maybe no. But I hear from lots of old timers that they just laugh when I ask them that question. You know, it's like, no, we're still screwed up sexually. And I think that a lot of other people who even aren't sexaholics are screwed up sexually. And be patient, relax. That's just the way it goes, you know. I think when it says Hashem is Osek in making Zivugim now, after he created the world all day long, that's what he's Osek in, Zivugim. It doesn't mean just Zivugim of unmarried people. I think he means getting married people together also. It's like, not push it. So, yay. So the scope, accepting the scope of real life is huge, and focusing on our sex or something like that is really missing what the program is about. Programs being shrunken down into one area, and it's not. The recovery comes from expanding it, making it about my will and my life over to the care of God, and that's why the second step doesn't talk about sobriety. It doesn't say... first step is, you know, I can't stop acting out and my life is a mess, right? Second step is, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Why doesn't it say could restore me to sobriety? It doesn't say that. It says restore me to sanity, because he's like, the program people are saying, psst, guess what? Your problem isn't your Avercutten Ba'adam business. Your problem is you're crazy, you know? You're not looking at life in its full scope. You've narrowed down life into your personal little drama, and you're a star-struck tragic figure, you know? And wake up, smell the cold coffee, you know? That's what, to me, where recovery is taking me. One more area. I choose faking whenever I can. Naturally, I'll choose faking over reality. I'll choose drama over whatever's really happening. That's like a knee-jerk thing for me. I'll choose black and white over, let's see the situation, what it really is, you know, pshara, right? Those things are natural for me. So in recovery, I'm outgrowing all those things. That's one of the goals here for me. I just wrote down my last line. I wrote down here is, as a sexaholic, I am, and I can't speak for the Essenons who are in the room. You know, I don't know what your extent of involvement in this, in your own issues are. But for me, if you relate to the SA guys in the 12 steps, maybe this applies to you too. I'm accustomed to faking, that's a strong word. I'm accustomed to putting on an act, okay? And embellishing things about myself religiously, socially, etc. And we all do that. You know, you don't dress at home the same way you dress outside. You want to, I don't understand what it's like to be a girl, but I can't imagine putting on makeup before I go out of the house, you know? But my wife does, you know? She understands, you know, this is the way it is. It's a certain amount of covet. You're going out, you know? I mean, and I do dress schlumpy sometimes, you know what I mean? I'm obviously missing something here. But when it comes to, I put on different makeup, you know? I put on a different outfit. When I go out, I act like one thing. And then I come home and they'll say, you know, I'm so polite. I'll say to the nahag, oh, todah rabah nahag, and then I'll come home mad at my wife for not giving me sex the night before. Still mad, and it's already the evening of the day after, you know? What happened to Mr. Nice Guy, you know? So I'll put on a whole persona, and, you know, that's not really me. Why am I putting on this whole persona? I think it's because I'm trying to get things that I don't think I even really deserve. If I really was myself, and I put myself out there, and I acted myself, I'm afraid that no one would like me. You know, everybody would hate me. You know, and that's a mistake. That's a big mistake. Even in Israel, where they don't say "excuse me," you know that joke, you know, the whatever. We're still putting on a persona here. I'm sure it's still the same. So I am a guy that's accustomed to to putting on an act in order to get all kinds of things I don't deserve, look how far I have to go. I have to stop thinking that I don't deserve to be loved. I have to stop, because it's Narishkeit. My wife is married to me for 11 years when I started sobriety. You know, she loved me then. My sponsor told me on the phone one day, I was maybe 2 years in the program, 3 years in the program, I was talking about my wife this, my wife that, my wife the other thing. You know the guy, if you're sponsoring anybody in SA, you know that that's what you get. So if they're married still. So it's like, you know, he was finally, he says to me like, first of all, will you leave her alone, you know? Second of all, that was around that time I was telling her, trying to get her to go to Essendon, which was like, would have been a huge mistake, I think. Third of all, it's crazy. He says to me, you know, she did this and this and this for you? Yeah. Even though you were, you know, your history and she knows this? Yeah, he says, you know, your wife really loves you. And I was like, quiet. Really? Yeah, I guess so. You know? It's funny, hearing that come from my sponsor in the middle of talking about complaining her, for me, it was kind of like the famous story that everybody knows about, Elazar ben Derdaya finding out from the hooker in the middle of having sex with her, you know, you're going to hell for this. You know, he wasn't expecting to hear it from her then, and all of a sudden, it made it into his heart, it kind of slipped under his radar, like, uh-oh, you know? For me, it was the same thing. It's so ironic that it's the same thing for love, you know? To find out that she... that I can be loved was a shock. Same thing with the fourth step. Accepting myself, finding out that I'm acceptable, that this is who I am. The reality is actually, it's neither good nor bad. It's the reality, and being able to live with it, getting comfortable with reality, was a major shock for me. If you're doing your fourth step, and you just go fourth step, and you finish it, and then there's no chidushim. You know, I checked out all the boxes. Yeah, pride, ego. Yeah, I got it. Okay, next. There's no chidushim, you're doing something wrong. But again, I'm talking just about program. But this, to me, this relates to this idea of having to put on a persona because I don't believe that I deserve the normal things that people deserve. As an SA, I think that what's typical for me is to believe that I am the best keeper of my secrets. And I'm the worst keeper of my secrets, because as long as I keep my secrets to myself, I'm going to keep acting out. And then eventually I'll get caught. So then everyone's going to know. Because eventually we get caught. And so I'm really the worst keeper of my secrets. If I open up to you all to save people about my secrets, it's actually better. I'm better off. It's kind of a weird idea. The same thing with the relationship. I feel like I can't imagine that she actually has somewhere deep inside her this positive feeling. She hasn't left me. There's a reason she hasn't left me. It's not just for this. It's not just for that. There's a connection here. It takes tremendous humility to just say, okay, we have this connection. How about we stop focusing on this big adventure that we want to focus on and talk about life? You know, talk about things in the big picture again. I don't have to put on a persona so much now. It's just you and me. So my wife and I are slowly getting there. It might sound sad to normal people, but I mean, for me, it's not sad at all, because I know the option is never getting there. We're going for walks. We're talking. We're taking time. I'm starting to share my program with her a lot, in little ways. And that's been progressing over the past few years, of course. One more thing before I go on. I think I said something before about trust. About trust. I have. Where's my chip? Good heavens. Oh, there it is. So this is my 24-hour chip. I love it. And it's made out of brass because it's real. I talked about this the other day. You go to the average meeting that has chips, they give you this crappy chip for 24 hours, you know? It's made out of some... I could probably break it like that. I've never tried. But then you have these fancy chips made out of brass are for people with like over a year or 2 years or 10 years or something like that. So I got one of those crappy chips when I was 5 years sober and realized that I'm still lusting my brains out sometimes. And I need to really focus on just today, living with today, as opposed to holding my breath for today or anything like that. And I went to the AA central office and I got myself a real chip, you know, because in AA they for some reason they respect 24 hours. In SA they don't, I guess. So I was talking about yesterday. Why is it? So I mentioned to my wife this thing. This just came up. I said, you know, I said, what's that? I said, oh, it's my 24-hour chip. And I said to her, you know, it's a Gesunder coin over here because they gave me this crappy one, and I wanted a real one because today is awesome, you know? And then she says to me, nah, 24 hours isn't a big deal, you know? You know, stay sober for a day, big deal. And I was like, well, what are you talking about? She's not a sexaholic. She doesn't know what it's like. So then we talked about it a little bit, and I realized I was going to end up arguing with her, and I don't want to go there. We hardly argue. We used to argue all the time, but trust is another level in the relationship that really doesn't have that much to do, it seems, with sobriety, because at first glance, you know. She's right, 24 hours, you're sober, so now I'm supposed to trust you? What does that mean to me? So you're sober for one day. What does that give me? And the answer is, it doesn't really give her very much. But if she realized that the only way to be sober for, you know, 20 years, 30 years, is to be sober today, then she would appreciate what today means. Does that mean that she should trust me after I'm sober for one day? You've got to be kidding. My wife... made sure that we don't get pregnant for at least 2.5 years after finding out about my problem, 3 years maybe it was or something. And by the way, she, I hope this isn't saying too much, but she wanted to have more kids, okay? A couple of years ago, she realized, like, she's upset we only have so many kids. She wanted to have at least one more kid. But she worked out the years and saw how, you know, well, you know, here with these two kids were too close, and then there was a space over here for your acting out, and then there was a space over here. Why was there a space over there? Oh, because we were just scared to have another kid. And then I said, and I was crestfallen, and I said to her, you know, in the discussion, I said, oy vey, you know, you must be really upset because of those like 3 or 4 years, whatever it is, before we had another kid since you found out about my acting. And she says, no, I'm not upset about that at all. You didn't prevent me from having another kid. This is our marriage. You're a sick man. You were ill for 3-4 years it took for our relationship to progress past that point. That's not missed time. That's our time. We couldn't have had a child in that period of time. But after that, there's a 3-year period somewhere after having the next kid where I think the only reason we didn't have another kid was because we were scared to have another kid because it was hard, and I regret that. And I realized that that's an appreciation. She was showing an appreciation for the process that we're going through together as something real, as opposed to some accident that happened, that, oh, you tripped over sexaholism. When will you get better already so we can get back to real life? No, this is our life. You know, I'm not the sexaholic. She's not the sexaholic. She's not saying that she's ill. She's saying our marriage is ill, you know? I mean, if somebody says, my husband's ill, and then they divorce them because they're ill, that's a weird relationship too, you know? Something's weird there. And that happens, you know? Just wanted to mention that. The 24 hours. So how does the trust happen? I asked my wife this. The trust happens like this. When she starts seeing that I'm bringing my program, that I'm living my program values or whatever, in other words, normal, in many areas of my life. Like, when I say to her, I'm on my way home from work, and I come home from work, or if I'm not coming home from work, I call her and I tell her, you know, I'm going to be late, as opposed to disappearing. If I stop losing my temper and screaming at the kids and fighting with them as though they're in competition with me, because I'm also 9 years old, you know what I mean? My sponsor once asked me, how old are you? And I said, he said, I was talking about this, and I was saying, man, I feel so immature. And he said to me, when did you start acting out? I said, about 13, something like that, 14. And he says, how many years have you been sober? I said, I don't remember what it was, you know, 2 years, 3 years. He goes, okay, so you're 16 now, you know? Congratulations. And he walked out of the room. I was like, you jerk, you know? And, but he was right, you know? We stop growing up when we discover our drug. And I think our marriages stop growing also when the spouse discovers this sexaholic I have to control. As soon as that happens, you know, I think the relationship immediately stops, and then it starts growing again from when that changes. Once again, I'll just mention my wife. She and I have not watched our wedding video maybe more than once, twice. We had a video even though it was back in 86. We haven't watched it much because I said to her, you want to watch a video? And she says, not really, you know? I said, why not? She says, because the day you got sober is a better day for me in my life than the day that we got married. And I was like, she wasn't angry about it. She was just saying, this is the way it is. The day you got sober is the number one day in my life I see now in retrospect. The day that we got married, number two, you know? Number three. Anyway, whoops. So does that mean, by the way, that, red flag, she's living vicariously, she's living through my sobriety? No, it's just that she wants to have a real relationship. That's really important to her. So as far as our day together, you know, our relationship, when I get sober, that has meaning for her. Now, let me put this into perspective. We got into a fight every Monday night, because I went to a meeting every Monday night. So we got into a fight every Monday night. She hated me going to meetings. She hated me going to conferences. She would cry at home alone, and I would pick up the phone Motzei Shabbos and call her back after the conference, say, oh, how you doing? And she would be crying. She would be upset, or she would be like, oh, I'm okay, and not talking. You know, basically, it was horrible, but I felt like I had to do this. The meetings I knew I had to do, the conferences was on the edge, that was ripping my guts out. But anyway, but I did them. And I made a pshara with my wife, thank God we had started doing gray instead of black and white. I made an agreement with her that I'm gonna go to one conference a year and no more. So that was good for a couple of years. Then somebody invited me to speak at the next conference and I couldn't say no. So that became two conferences a year. Anyway. But now it's not so bad, really. It's just what are the neighbors going to say, and we're working that out, and that's the issue. But again, coming back to the point, we got into a fight weekly, at least, starting recovery, about recovery. She hated recovery. She, for 5 years maybe, she hated me going to meetings, hated my recovery, didn't want to hear about 12 steps. I already poisoned the atmosphere by leaving the big book around and asking her to go to Essanon and other stupid things. It was like my sponsor said, leave her alone, for God's sakes. And 10 years later, she came to Essanon to go to a few meetings, and I said to her in passing one day, why did it take you 10 years? Why didn't you find out before? Because she said, I want to go to see what it's about. Well, why didn't you find out? Just because I was still left such a bitter taste in my mouth when you were trying to force me to go. And I didn't think I was forcing her to go. I was just suggesting it, you know? But apparently, my suggestions are a lot different than I think they are. It's manipulation, so I didn't realize it. So anyhow, she, where in the world was I?
Trust.
About the trust, yeah. So we fought about recovery. She said to me once, the only good thing about the recovery is your sponsor. He's the only thing that's been good for you. You know, she didn't understand what I was doing in the meetings. You know, sometimes she would joke around with me about how, you know, funny things that she thought we did in the meeting, which I won't repeat here. Anyway, she has a sense of humor about it, thank God. If she can joke around about it, I know that I'm okay. If you can't joke around about it at all, you hear laughter in meetings. And I remember my hearing from guys and from spouses, like, how dare you laugh in a meeting? This is horrifying. It's such a tragedy which would happen. Because if we can't laugh about it, we're not going to get anywhere. Because Because we're not laughing about the problem saying, isn't that hilarious that we're sexaholics? No, we're saying, like, you know, number one, life does go on and we need to live in a different way. Boy, are we stupid in our addiction, you know, and we can laugh at that person. Reb Shlomo Shvedron used to always talk that way. He would have the crowd rolling in laughter, and then he would say, and guess what, that's you, you know. And really, I mean, it was laughter, and that's what we do in the meetings, and we know we're laughing at our own selves. My wife and I can laugh now about a lot of things, about our program. By the way, I just want to throw in, when I get a lustful thought, I usually chuckle, because I think it's kind of funny. I'll say to myself, there you go again, you know, back again. You suffered so much, and it's like, it's not a sad laugh, like a pathetic laugh. I'm just kind of laughing. It, to me, it's just kind of funny that I could possibly want to do something that's like, you know, okay, throw your whole life away in 5 minutes, you know. I just laugh. And I could be laying in bed, and I'll chuckle. And hopefully none of you will be there, but if you were, you would say, you know, what are you laughing about? And my wife knows, you know, I just had some stupid thought again, and I just laughed about it. What was it? Well, it could have been something embarrassing, like checking out our neighbor's daughter, or thinking about our neighbor's being sexual, or some other disgusting thing. But for me, you know, it's neither disgusting nor nice, it's just stupid. It's just these are thoughts that come into my mind, you know. They're not plans, they're thoughts that come into my mind. And, you know, so I'm looking at things and I'm behaving in a little bit of a different way because I'm not afraid of lust anymore, you know. I'm not saying that I'm not afraid of like, if I'm okay with lusting. I'm just not afraid. I'm not afraid of God, and I'm not afraid of lust, and I'm not afraid of my acting out. You know, being not afraid of God, by the way, sounds like a little bit of a strange idea, but because we talk about Yir Shamayim, but I saw in a sefer called Toldos Yaakov Yosef, which I generally don't understand, but I opened it up and I read through a half of the parsha once, and I saw that he quoted from the Maggid that fear of God is something that a lot of people think is Yir Shamayim, and it's not. Fear of God means, oh, look out, God is coming. He's like a loose cannon. You never know what he's going to do. He'll take away your children. He'll kill you. He'll this, he'll that. And it's like, you know, basically God's a jerk. And that's not religion at all. So finding out a different way to be is huge part of recovery as a religious person, I think. And my natural thing is I'm terrified. My wife has told me this many times, you're scared of me. She realized, you're frightened of me. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I am. That's a very, very sad commentary. Now, guess what? She's afraid of me too. She's afraid that I'm going to go, not today, thank God, but she's afraid that I'm going to give her a disease or something. She's afraid that I'm lying to her. She's afraid that she's afraid of that. So we need time, we need healing, and what goes around comes around, you know, it's a circle. You know, I don't wear a ring, but she does, and it's a circle. And there's no, well, this is my half and this is your half. That's not the way that it really works as a couple. There's this circle, and I have to live my business, she has to live her business. And if I do my business and she does her business, then we function as a circle. If I do her business and she does my business, then we're not a circle anymore. We're like two, it's not even a ring. We're separate, completely separated. And it's weird how that works. I want to close with something. I want to close with something that I wish I had said yesterday. Not yesterday, the other day, because it's just a seven-step thing. And I think that it relates very strongly also to the relationship dynamic thing. Because it's step 4, 5, 6, 7. I walked into shul. I told this story three times so far, since it happened like a year and a half ago. My son got bar mitzvah recently, and we started going to shul together. in the morning. He didn't want to go to shul until he was bar mitzvah, and he had to go. He was like, oh no, that's going to be hard. But whatever, okay, you have to pick your battles, you know what I mean? So this was one battle that we picked, you know, for now. And he was okay, it wasn't a battle. So we started coming to shul every morning, pretty much, to shul. And I'm late to everything, almost. Let's say gray. I'm late to most things, and I really am. I consider that part of growing up. To be honest with you, I can say that to other people. I can't say it without being angry, but I can say that to you honestly. And I'm obviously still growing up. And we come into shul 8 o'clock minyan, and we park ourselves and start putting the tefillin on. And this guy sitting in the row behind me is this guy who I respect very much. Okay, Chassidish guy, great guy. Kids that are maybe not even bar mitzvah, and they're already dressing long and acting like bar mitzvah and this and that and frum and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, like, my son doesn't open up a Gemara when he's bored, and my son doesn't do this, and my son doesn't do that. And here I am walking in 10 minutes late, and I'm imagining what he's thinking to himself. That, you're such a jerk, you're coming into Minyan, you're screwing up your son, you know? So I feel guilty about that. And I'm thinking about it. And we're halfway through Psukah de Zimra, and I'm thinking about this and this. If God actually, you know what it says, Ha'adam Yirlei Naim, Ve'Hashem Yirlei Laleva, God sees the heart, or Elokim Yirlei Laleva, whatever the pasuk is. So if God sees my heart, and that's what I'm speaking to him. So here's, see, this is what chakras to me, you know, says, Ashrei Yoshvei, my God, what is that guy thinking of me? He's such a jerk for hating me. Yoshvei Beisecha, Od Yahalul Vesela. There's hefsiks all over, but I'm not even Yerzi Davening. So anyway, so it comes through the thing. I'm 3/4 of the way through Pesukim, and I'm thinking to myself, this is like a year and a half ago, I'm thinking, Dov, you're sacrificing your chakras because of approval from this guy. Who, I don't even know what he thinks of me. Now, why do I think he disapproves of me? Okay? I've heard people say, people, places, or things in your fourth step. It's very rare to me, I think, that there are things that we have resentment, like, oh, the yeshiva movement. I don't think so. I don't buy it. It's a Rebbe, it's a guy, it's somebody who told you once, where's your hat? You know, in the middle of davening. You have a resentment to somebody, you know? Somebody looked down at you for not dressing yeshivish, so you hate them. It's people. It's like Mark Twain said, I love the human race. It's people I can't stand. So it always comes down to people. So, okay, so why do I have a box for, oh, this guy, resentment, you know, why do I have that file? Because I tried to get a job for a sexaholic once who, in this guy's firm, and I talked to him about this guy, and he was in jail, and why don't you give him a job, la la la. And then, guess what? This guy had already worked for this guy, and he fired him because of his acting out. I didn't know that. So he gave me this whole long thing about, oh, I gave him so much, and you're coming and telling me something like I'm a no-good Nick, and I should have pity on him, and la la la. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. Never mind. So I have this whole feeling like this guy hates me, and I'm embarrassed in front of him. So now you know where that came from. A little history helps. Now you know the rest of the story. So okay, so we're davening, and here this guy's, that's what my finger was up for. And this guy, and when you're old you have to do things like that. And this guy's thinking about me, and I'm realizing I'm sacrificing my whole davening now. It's going to continue through the whole davening, and on my way to work, and maybe half of my day to work until I get distracted by life and forget about it. It's terrible. I can't stand this. I don't deserve this kind of pain. And by the way, that's a big nakuda. Sexaholic, we feel like we deserve pain because we're just used to being in so much pain all the time. Our tolerance to pain is like a diabetic guy walking with a pair of keys in his shoes, and you see it sticking out, and you go, take it out of your shoe, and he goes, what keys? You know, we're walking around, what pain? And we have like a hippopotamus sitting on us, you know? It's like, what pain? I'm okay. It's comical in a way, you know? So like this guy, so here I am walking in, and I'm thinking, I don't deserve this pain. I don't know what I deserve, but I don't deserve this pain. I'm giving this to myself. This is stupid. You know, I want chakras. You know, I want a normal chakras. You know, I'm not looking for rashash, turning my sitter upside down and shameless all day long. Just let me daven and that's it. So, fine. So, I thought I got to do 4, 5, 6, 7. Right? So, I thought to myself, whatever, I'm not going to waste your time. 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay? What am I upset at this guy for? Probably that Misa What am I jealous of? I'm jealous of him, definitely jealous. What is the thing that I'm the most jealous of him in the world? Definitely his son. Definitely his son. I'm jealous of his kids. Okay, so the way I was going to do my surrender of my jealousy is by davening for him. And I realized I have to daven for what I'm the most jealous of. And I davened, Hashem, let him please have nachas from his children. The hardest thing for me to say, because I'm so jealous of his nachas that he's probably having, and I don't want him to have the nachas, is like losach mode. I want to take it away from him. I want to have it. I don't want him to have nachas from his kids. I want him to know what it's like not to have nachas from your kids, and I want me to have nachas from my kids. That's how I am. Pretty bad guy, and here I am up here. How about you, huh? Anyway, so this is the way I am. So I'm thinking, I want him to have nachas from his kids, okay? First time I say it, it's kind of a lie, but God doesn't mind. And then the second time I say it, it's not so much of a lie. And I think to myself, the typical progress, I go through a process of praying for people. I think, if they were in a burning car, would I save him? Yeah. Do I know him at all? Do I know her at all? Would I save him? Would I save her? Yeah. Are they jerks? Yeah, I don't care. They're in a burning car. They're screaming, I'm going to save them. I'm a human being, you know? You don't even have to be a Jew. Rahmanim, whatever. You don't have to be that. You're just a human being, you know? You're not a human being. If you can turn around and walk away, oh, him? He's a Russia. Goodbye. So I can daven for him. And now, by the way, is he a Russia? Yeah, he doesn't like me. He's a Russia. That's how I work. So I would save him. I do care for him. Okay, so now it's a little more true. By the time it was like 4 or 5 times saying, God help him have nachas from his children, I really finally meant it. As soon as I meant it, I knew it, because the whole resentment slipped off my back. And then I could daven. And finish the davening. Okay, packed up the tefillin, get ready to go. And I feel a tap on my shoulder. It's this guy. And I turn around and go, what's going to be? You know, I turn around and go, yeah, you know, you're going to ruin all this now? You know, so he turns to me and he goes, you know, I know you were, I saw the way you were davening, you and your son were davening, and I'm like, uh-oh. And he goes, and I want to say that I'm very impressed at the way your son looks in the sitter the whole time when he's davening, and the other kids look around, and they start walking, and they start playing with their shoes, and your kid looks in the sitter, and he davens, and that's it. And I said, thank you. Is that his place? And he goes, yeah. And I want to give you a bracha that you should always have nachas from your children. This is what he says. This is what he says to me. The exact words that I was using when I was davening for him. Little did he know that I was davening for him because I hate him. And this is the bracha that he gives me. And I'm thinking to myself, and I'm staring at him. He's expecting me to say, amen, you know. And I'm like, and another minute goes by. Anyway, so let me translate that into the relationship quickly. When I read a piece from that book, oh, what a great chapter, what a great line. Life is hard. When we accept, I'm not going to read it again, but it's the first paragraph in A Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck, a classic book. The first chapter is, the first thing is just gorgeous, I think. And he says, life is difficult. As long as we expect it to be easy, it's hell. As soon as we accept completely that life is difficult and that there are difficult things we're going to have to do, and just living is difficult, which, by the way, is the introduction to Misos Yesharim. It says the same thing, if you read it. It's exactly the same thing. L'havdil. And he said, and life is difficult. As soon as we accept the difficulty in life, it's no longer difficult if we really accept it. And this is a fourth step thing. In my job, I work with amputees a lot. There are two kinds of amputees. Those who accept the fact that they're a one-legged man, let's say if it's a man, and those who do not accept the fact that they're a one-legged man, and they have to appear like a normal person all the time. And that's very important to them. Both of them will wear prostheses. Both of them will try to walk normally. One will be doing it, and I cannot blame them at a drop, me being a professional faker. I cannot blame them a drop. But there are those amputees who the thing that they're, when, as soon as their leg is removed, their big hope in life is to once again be normal, you know, to look normal, to appear normal, to once again be normal. Then there's the other guys who accept from the outset. They look down, like it's a famous story of Rav Noach Weinberg. He met a guy who was very old, very happy, an amputated leg. And he said to him, he says to him, what's your secret to being so happy? And you only have one leg, right? And he goes, yeah. But when I was 11, I got run over, the leg got chopped off, and I'm laying there, and I see my leg. And I thought to myself, as an 11-year-old boy, and this is a long time ago, maybe they were a lot more mature, and he says to himself, look down, and he says, I see my leg laying there. I'm either going to give up now as a one-legged man to the rest of my life. It's going to be hard for me to get married. It's going to be hard for me to have a job. Who knows what I'll be? I might be one of those guys on the street with a can, you know. What's going to be? I don't know. But I'm going to either accept now that I am a one-legged man and I'm going to make the best out of my life with what I've got, or I'm not going to accept that, and I'm basically going to die right now. I'll be dead from now. And Rav Noach said, and the guy says to Rav Noach, and he looks at him and goes, and I decided to be a one-legged, to be me, as me with one leg, and live this life that I've got now. And I'm happy, because life is good, you know? And Rav Noach said, thank you, because Rav Noach was a chacham, and he used to ask people who seemed happy, what's your secret, what's your secret, what's the secret, no matter who they are. So that's the same thing. Amputees, I've noticed, who are of that type, are happier people, and they don't burst into tears when they start talking about their terrible misfortune that they had, which is losing the leg, which makes life a lot harder. They don't burst into tears. They've adjusted to it because they have acceptance as opposed to knowledge. Knowledge we all have. Here we are, I'm a sexaholic and I'm in a marriage, you know? That's not acceptance. Acceptance is a whole other level of accepting, yeah, and this is mine. This is what I have. Now, what do I do with it? You know, that's the only door. It's like a wall. That's the only door out that I know, is acceptance. Like that last story in the AA Big Book, or one of the last stories, acceptance is the answer, or something like that, with this guy and his wife, Max, or something. It's a fantastic idea, and once we accept it, it's not hard because it's ours. And you don't see it as something that you shouldn't have. You have, you know. I don't fantasize about, I mean, I could, but I don't. I don't fantasize about driving a Maserati everywhere and having $1 billion and this and that, because I just don't relate to that. You know, I don't, there's a lot of things, everybody's different, but there's something that you could have that you don't even fantasize because you can't relate to it. And having a different life than I have is something I can't relate to. The more I accept that, the more peace I'm going to find in my life. And the object isn't just accepting it and laying down. The object is living with it. There are a lot of us that we have some kind of a tsa'ar, some kind of a tsara that happens. And we feel like, okay, now I'm living b'di'evid. So that's not acceptance either. And it's so easy to do that. And I'm not saying that I do it. If I really did this, I would have a perfect third step. And I probably wouldn't even need... I certainly wouldn't need any more steps. I don't even know if I'd be here, you know? I would be going around with no problem at all. I wouldn't need to lust, that's for sure, because I'm always comfortable. I don't have that, you know? But I'm just speaking out about it because I can touch it, you know? I can touch it with my, you know? I can feel it, you know? So it's the only way that I know of to peace is acceptance of what I have instead of trying to get out of it, finding out a way to live with it in a positive way instead of trying to escape, which is my knee-jerk reaction as a sexaholic. I just want to escape, which is what I was talking about before. 90% of the time when I was lusting before, it wasn't because I was triggered, it was because I've been trying to escape life. That's my baseline. Run away. Work sucks, marriage stinks, this is that, I don't know, it's so hard, you know, I can't do it, I'm afraid I'll fail, That's my baseline. Now, I'm looking for ways out all the time. No wonder I'm triggered all the time, because I'm always looking for a way out. Same thing in the relationship, I'm always looking for a way out, you're a jerk, you know, that's a great way out of the relationship, you know. So, my wife and I fight a lot less now, that's the only reason why. we have no more shalom bias in implicit, like real shalom bias now. We just have very few reasons to escape. So we're not looking to point the finger at the other person. That's all. So we get busy with better stuff, like trying to make things better, you know. I've talked too much already, I'm sorry. How much time do we have left?
40 minutes.
Oh.
Well, we started with, do you want to
have a break? Yeah, so...
Doc, do you need a break?
No, I'm not dizzy. Yesterday, for some reason, I was talking and getting dizzy. I don't know why.
Very hot yesterday.
Yeah, oh, that's what it was. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I get like a weird feeling in my head, like I'm dizzy. Anyway, if people want to share about stuff, we have a according to Dovi, who spoke yesterday, I think the agreement is that people who have a spouse here, you can share, and then the spouse has first dibs at sharing. If you don't have a spouse here, it's okay, I think is what he said to share. If you don't have a spouse here, if you aren't in a marriage, please don't share here. Not because we're not interested in what you have to say, but because we want to give time for the people here, and that's what this group is for marriage specifically. Thank you. Go ahead. Shlomi.
It really resonated with this idea about living life, having a positive thing that you're living. In other words, that the sexualism is getting in the way of my life. Sexualism is getting in the way of my life, and 12 steps helps me so that I can live life. It's not this narrow, very narrow thing that which you're describing, you know, yes, actor, or not actor. So, but what I struggle with is that with meetings and phone calls and the step work and all these things, and also I work and then trying to live life, so to speak. So I feel as though I don't have time, you know, for it feels that the things like meetings and all these things that eating up so much time that I feel that my life is now working, and then after work or in between, I'm trying to do meetings and things like this. My wife and I want to go on a date with that on top meeting or some step work, and so I struggle with just trying to find a balance using the program to live life but having time for life, you know. I don't know if it could.
How long have you been in this?
3 years.
Yeah. If I may, playing therapist. Do both of you feel that way? It's taking away a lot of time from real life?
No, it's the same thing. It takes time, but not the same as that there is no time.
Yeah, so is that black and white hand? It takes up most time.
Yeah. If I may, did you want to share? Okay. Again, if I point to somebody as the spouse and you're not, I'm sorry. You might just be sitting next to each other. I don't know. Or they may be sitting on opposite sides of the room. I just want to share. Other people could share a lot on that, I'm sure, also. Fourth step, okay? When do I work a fourth step, really? I can work a fourth step because my sponsor asked me to write these things, but when do I really work my fourth step? When these things become problems for me. So if it's not really a problem and I'm looking for problems, so the fourth step is going to be chaser a little bit. You know, it's like kind of weak. So because then how are you going to do a sixth step on something that you don't really consider as a problem, just theoretically? You see how it gets in the way. You're not going to succeed much with six and seven, which isn't a tragedy, but you just won't. So the question that I have is, like, is it actually a problem? And that's why I asked her, because, like, is it really a problem? Or is it just something you don't like, you know? So if it's just something you don't like, okay. But if it becomes a problem, so then it's time to look for a solution. So each person has to decide for themselves where that line is. I don't know. I talked before about how I went to too many meetings. You know, the answer isn't more meetings for me. The answer is working my program more, that, you know, inside my living. You know, so in other words, for me, I personally, I go to one meeting a week. And for me, it's enough for me to have a few minutes a day where I write myself these notes, you know, and I have my notepad and I'm you know filling that, and I have things that I need to write, step work. I'll have some kind of an idea that has to do with some feeling in me, and I'll write it down. I'll say, what step does that relate to? And I'll do a few minutes of written work here and there. Written work to me is far better. Putting on the computer to me does nothing. Maybe it's because I didn't grow up typing on a computer, but I can't put my feelings. When I put my feelings down on paper, it's b'chosam yad kol adambo. This is my handwriting. It means something to me psychologically, emotionally. I don't know. That's my plug for that. But I write stuff down. Get it out of myself onto paper. I share it, you know, and I try to work a little piece of certain steps over the course of my day just through working. And then I might not have the time to talk to somebody, but I might be able to make a call later and say, you know, I feel like this and this and this. I want to surrender this thing. Does that sound like step 4, 5, 6 to you? Yeah, okay, good. And then I can go on my own and do a little step 7 in 3 seconds. How long does it take, you know? So to me, that gives me more, and it saves me more time, too. It's more economical. So for me to go to more meetings, some people are going to more meetings to substitute for doing program work. You know, I'm not accusing you of that at all. I'm not saying that. You know, it's sometimes not necessary to do that. Sometimes it is. Sometimes we need to go to meetings to get out of myself. You know, to hear other people and get out of myself. I need to go to a meeting. Very, very often that's the case. That's all I have to say. I'm sorry. Yeah. Claire.
So I'm one of these people who, and it was Claire, I was created in the image of God. I'm one of these people who think you should, you know, put your best foot forward when you go out of the house. And for recovery, so I used to live in my robe at home and not care what I looked like. And so when I went out, I would get my act together. And in recovery, I feel like, well, I don't want to just look good when I go out. I want to look good and feel good. I feel better when I'm dressed, when I'm all put together physically. And it's kind of almost everything you said. I keep telling my husband, I love you. It's like your recovery is just so amazing to me. But there's one piece I feel like it's different, and I'm wondering what you have to say about this. The idea that just because I'm married doesn't mean I shouldn't be putting my best foot forward at home. If anything, I should try harder at home. And not care so much when I go out is what I think my goal is. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I feel like I have to put my best foot forward as part of my living amends to my wife. You know what I'm saying? One time my therapist said to me, the one that suggested that I go to SA, said to me something that sounds very not nice, but she didn't mean it that way. I said to her, you know, my wife, my constant refrain is, my wife isn't in the mood for sex, my wife doesn't want any of that. So, because that's the way that my particular relationship is. And she said, well, maybe she doesn't find you attractive. So now she didn't mean that she thinks you're ugly. That's not what she meant. What she meant was, maybe she's upset at you. Maybe the fact that you come late from work, you come in from 8 o'clock and you expect her to be happy about that. You know, you come, you don't treat her with respect. You know, you don't treat her like she's a person that you love. You treat a stranger on the phone nicer than you treat her, with more respect than you treat your wife. So she's not attracted to you, you know? So for me, I am not in such a good mood. Does that feel like I'm being fake to try to be extra nice at home then? I'm trying to relate this to what you're saying. I'm trying to put my best foot forward in terms of my behavior. That's part of my living amends. My ninth step amends is mostly a living amends. It's mostly not saying, I'm sorry, you know, what you got from me, you didn't you didn't deserve that, and that was wrong behavior. I'll try to do better. You know, excuse me, it's not like that. It's a living amends. It's behaving in a way that before I treated her like she was the source of all my problems. And now I'm going to treat her like a human being, you know?
This sounds to me like the opposite of what you were saying before. That's what I was asking.
Go ahead. Why?
No, you're saying that, so now you don't have to try so hard. This
right.
is how you feel. So
right.
that's where it is.
Right, right,
but
right.
I'm saying, like,
right.
no, I think it's important for me to check, act as if sometimes, and go talk to my sponsor that was bothering me.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Like, well, when it's something that's really bothering me about her, that's one thing. When it's something that it's bothering me about me, and that has a bad effect on her, like for example, if I'm upset with myself because I did something wrong,
yeah.
for me to walk around with that, it's easy for me to walk around with low self-esteem, a low self-image, and lash out at her for the littlest criticism that she gives to me.
Right.
You know, that's natural. So part of my 9-step amends is going to be, like you're saying, perhaps, if I can't feel okay about myself, at least I'm going to act as if, you know, I'm going to be pleasant and, you know, helpful at home and act, you know, in a more positive way. I'm not gonna choose that path of feeling like a piece of garbage, you know. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to something like you know, she did something to me that I don't like. Right now, it's more important for me to communicate about that and not act as if, you know.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So there's a time and a place for me to. You know, part of my living amends is letting her get away with some stuff that, in all rights, she shouldn't really get away with.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to be extra tolerant because, boy, oh boy, if I looked at porn day and night, I drove out to see things, I phone sex, chatting, sex chatting, things like that. If my wife did 1/100th of what I did, I would either kill myself, kill her, or I don't know, go out of my mind. Because like I said before, if my wife laughs at another man's jokes, I feel like I'm gonna die. You know, I feel like, oh, she likes him more than she likes me. You know, she laughed at his joke. It's a tragedy, you know? And it's like, you know, I'm telling you the truth. We're living with my brother and sister-in-law. If my brother-in-law is speaking, like, something funny, and she's listening and smiling like, inside I feel like, ugh, oh no, this can't be right, you know? It's like, what's the matter with me? That's not... And yet my sister-in-law, it's okay for her to smile and laugh at my jokes all day long. Why is that okay? I wonder. You know, I'm very sensitive in that respect. Very sensitive, and I need to just accept that. It's not evil. It's just the way that I am. So my part of my living amends is letting my wife not, you know, do things, you know, obviously have trysts with other guys. I mean, that has nothing to do with sexaholism at all. That's not part of marriage. But being able to talk to another guy on the phone and not be going crazy, that's something that I need to be able to do. If my wife were doing some things that are acting out, like looking at porn or something like that, I couldn't survive, though. That hasn't changed. I can't survive. I can't imagine my wife doing the things that I... So letting her get away with all the acting out that I was doing is not the solution. There's a line that I have to draw somewhere, and I'm not the greatest judge of what that line should be. You know? I'm not the greatest judge of what that line should be. I'll draw that line perhaps earlier than it should be drawn, but you know, that's something that I would bring up to a therapist. You know, usually a third party is very useful for these things because they'll recognize, like, what? And for me, it's, you know, it's unrecognizable. I got to move on. Anybody?
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right.
I'm Shaul. I'm also a sex Helen. I just want to actually relate to something I heard before about time to work program. What I've noticed for myself is that I don't spend a fraction of the time on my program that I spend acting out. So when I was acting out, so I certainly wasn't focused on quality of life. And since in program, not working program, and I'm not spending as much time in my program as I did acting out, so if I do the math, there should be plenty of extra time for me to actually live life and do that. And if that's not happening by me, then there's something screwy, because the math is okay. There's nothing wrong with the math. So there's something screwy by me. And that's usually the case. In other words, I don't feel like I'm spending enough time with life. I do feel sometimes that, you know, program takes too much time. But there's something screwy in that. Something over here is out of sorts.
You know, we're not all well people in this room. You know what I mean? So some of us have this screwy idea of what's like okay and what's like abnormal and stuff. And I've spoken to guys who, I'm doing 90-90 now. And I'm like, okay, fine. Which it's a great tool to accept the seriousness and realness of your problem, 90-90. Fantastic tool. If I'm having a problem accepting the realness of this problem, going to a meeting a day is a wonderful tool. But it's no substitute for recovery. You know, it doesn't magically solve my problems. Going to the first conference that I went to was also a shock to my system. Here I am spending $500 flying on an airplane with all these real people going to business and real things, and they're doing real stuff, and now I'm meeting with all these real strangers, a room of 1,000 real people, you know, of all different walks of life, and then finally, like, it dawned on me, wow, this problem is real. This is real. This is just as real as anybody else on the plane, going to bar mitzvah, going to work, going to here, going to there. And I realized that I had been missing that feeling. I thought this was a project I was doing, acting out. This recovery was a project. Well, I have a number of projects, you know. So it's like, anyway, so accepting the realness of it, 90-90 helps a lot of people with that. Going to meetings, of course, you know, the halal helps with that. But then I find out from this guy who's doing 90-90 that this is 90-90 on top of the 3 nights a week that he's not home with his wife and kids, that he normally goes to his home groups because he's going to AA, OA, and SA. So now he's like, he really has no time to live. So I'm thinking to myself, oh, so in other words, you've decided, perhaps, that instead of engaging in life, you're going to escape from life by going to meetings and program stuff. Just before you were doing it with acting out and overeating and gambling, and now you're doing it with meetings and guys on the phone. So I used to post on a blog, on one of these from recovery blogs. I stopped doing it because the 10th night in a row that my wife goes to sleep by herself because I'm clicking away on the computer, of course, when we're not mutter. So, you know, it's like I realize something's wrong with this picture, you know? Like, why am I going to sleep late? Why is this superseding my life? So there's a balance that we need, and we suck at balance. Yes?
I'm Shevach.
Hi, Shevach.
I've been living out of the house for over 20 months, and taking the time to do a lot more than the 90-90. I get 9 meetings a week in 3 different fellowships. And I found that a good rule for me is, yeah, those are meetings I go to. I've got 2 of my favorite meetings that I try not to miss, but everything else, I don't mind missing. Sometimes it's only 4 meetings a week, 3 meetings a week. And being on my own, so I have the luxury of doing that.
Yes.
And my basic rule is, if I want to go to the meeting, so it's no problem missing it. But if I really don't want to get to a meeting, and even a client comes in after hours, I'll say, look, you have to come back tomorrow. I've got a previous engagement.
Yes.
And I'll try to go to it if I, it's like the hafuch al hafuch.
Yes.
That if I really want to go there, I don't mind missing a meeting. I don't mind skipping something. It's not, my recovery is not dependent on that thing right now. My recovery is dependent on living life right now. And if nothing else is happening, so great, I've got my meetings. And sometimes, some weeks I go to 9 meetings, 2 of them are on the telephone. But I can miss them. I can miss them. 2 weeks ago I was home for Shabbos, and on Friday there were guests over from Chutz Lars, my wife's family. And I just told her, I chose to skip the Friday prison group telephone meeting today so we can be together with the feeling of semblance of family life, and knowing that that's really the goal. It's the goal isn't to be addicted to meetings.
If I can just share it first quickly, you bring up a good point. Something that you said, definitely being freer, you know. I could do more meetings. If I feel like I need to have the meeting, so then chances are, like I think the Baal Shem Tov used to say, if you feel like you're very far from the Ribbono Shel Olam, then you're probably okay. You know, if you feel like you're really, really close and everything's fine, so then you're probably not okay. You know, so if I feel like I don't want to go, so then there's usually a reason why I don't want to go. Part of my, again, I hope I'm not beating a dead horse. A major part of my recovery for me is living life as part of the different relationships that I have in my life. For my children, I was competing with them actually, and that was a big problem. And that's why I'm great with 2-year-olds. I'm great with 3-year-olds. When they get an ego around 7, 8, forget it. Now it's like, hey, what do you want? You know, because I relate, you know? We're like competing all of a sudden. And all of a sudden, around that age, I start having tremendous problems. Why? Because that's where I'm holding a little bit. And I feel like we're in competition, I believe. So we have all kinds of tsaras with children around that age. And now, in our 2 sobriety babies, I looked out. I knew, red flag. Happy birthday to you, 9 years old. Oh, crap, you know? It was like, I knew this is going to be trouble, you know? So thank God, things have been okay. But the amends is being present. And part of being present is being there, you know? So it's not the point that it would have driven my wife and kids crazy if I wouldn't come to the wedding of our cousins, or if I would have said, I'll come, but then I have to leave early to go to the meeting. It's not the difficulty isn't that it would have driven them crazy and it's not nice. The difficulty is that unless I feel like I'm going to act out, okay, if I feel like I'm going to act out, that's another story. I have to call my sponsor and ask in that situation, please help me decide what I should do. You know, it's different. But if I feel like, you know, I can engage in this and be here, so then part of my 9th step amends, even if I'm not at the 9th step, part of my recovery itself is engaging in real life and being a father, being a husband, being a... You know, it's funny, in a marriage, my sponsor taught me this gorgeous thing. He said there's 3 things in marriage, you know, and I thought he was going to say, you know, 3 partners and banking a baby, blah, blah. But he's Catholic, he didn't hear that, Gemara. There's 3 parts in a marriage. There's you... There's your wife, and then there's your marriage. And you have to, and he suggested, I'm saying you have to, every time I say you have to, I try to remember not to do that. He suggested looking at those 3 things, and there are some things you do for yourself, there are some things you do for your wife, and there are some things you don't do for either of you. You do them for your marriage as though it's a third being, a living being. And thinking about that way was very helpful to us. And my wife and I have had many meetings of 2. Do they do that here? Meetings of 2? You, husband and wife, you go for a walk together, okay? So sometimes we have a meeting of 2 where there's no crosstalk. Roger's rules, whatever you call it. There's no crosstalk. There's no commenting directly on what the other person said. You know, da da da. There's no interruption. And we don't use a timer either, actually. And we give a chance. Who goes first? You go. Whoever. And then my wife will talk, and she'll say, you know, I feel like this when my husband does this and this and this and this and this. And it's just the two of us talking, and we're talking about our husband, our wife. And it's great. It's great. And it's sort of like a straw man. You're using a straw man. You can talk about this. As long as you're not talking about you, it doesn't trigger, it doesn't trigger emotional, like, inside, you know? So it's very helpful. So it's just a little trick for two people in a relationship creating a safe place, you know? So we have maybe four or five times we've had to have. We only do it when we really have to because we hate it. But it's like writing program work. I hate it, but every time I do it, I go, hey, why haven't I been doing this all day? So we'll have a meeting of two, and by the end of the meeting, and then I'll be able to say how I feel. Well, my wife does da-da-da-da-da-da, and I have to try to be honest and not comment on what she says and say, oh, yeah, you know, no. I'm just sharing how I feel. You know, I'm trying. You have to just try. You're not going to do it perfectly. You have to try. And then the other person, you know, can share, and you can go back and forth until, you know, the babysitter is calling you. Where are you, you know? So you know, and that's going to be our talks, and I can't recall a meeting of two that we've ever had that ended with us hating each other. You know, it's always been a feeling of love and mutual respect after the meeting of two, because she understands me better, because I'm not talking about her. Because I always think, if I can only tell you how I feel about you, then you would understand. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. Because that's all personal, you know? My friend said to me, your main value of your sponsor is that he's not you. That's your main value of your sponsor. Your spouse, unless you were just married 6 months ago, your spouse is partially you, you know, in that respect. Not to say that they're you, like physically maybe, but you're intertwined emotionally, and what the other person thinks about me affects me. There's an intertwining there. It needs to be separated in order for there to be any progress ahead. I have to be able to talk about me instead of the way you treat me. I got to talk about me and my feelings. That's a very hard thing to do, especially for a guy like me who feels like, you know, oh my God, Osama bin Laden hates me. I can't stand that. I have to explain to him why I'm a nice guy, you know? It's not natural for me to separate other people from me, you know? I'm sorry. Who just said what? It was you. You didn't have a chance to share. If you want to.
Yeah. Okay. My name is Dina.
Dina.
I've been in the program for a year and 3 months. The things that you're saying about not just being in the recovery, but being in your whole life. We haven't really had a marriage for a long time now. We meet sometimes for Shabbat, sometimes for Chagim. We've had a lot of hostilities during the last year and a half. Reaching Beis Din, coming out of Beis Din, starting mediation, recovery. But it's all program work. And on my way here, I had something very funny happen, and I realized it's such a metaphor for what's going on. Our couple mediator was going on about this song that I'm the lady and you're my man. And I went and got this ringtone for my phone. So when he calls, I have this song. I'm your lady, you're my man. Whenever you reach for me, I'll do all that I can. We're heading for something, somewhere we've never been.
I'll close my ears, you can sing.
I am your lady.
Please, stop.
Sometimes I'm frightened, but I'm willing to love, mm-hmm. The power of love. And so I put this on my phone together with a picture of Sheva, so that when he calls, his picture comes up, and I hear this song, and it's only been a week. And as I was driving along, I was listening to the song, it's thumb pressing it, he wasn't calling me. And I realized that what happened is that he calls me and I don't pick up because I'm listening to the song. And really, the metaphor is, it's true, I'm going to switch it. The metaphor is that I'm so busy trying to work out, like, who I am, what I'm supposed to do next, what I'm supposed to do today, what my feelings are, what they aren't, coming out of denial, blah, blah, blah. He's reaching out to me, he's calling me. And I'm like, oh, what am I supposed to do now? Let's see. No, just respond, you know, just let him reach out. So we're really stuck in this stage that we're still trying to work out who we are and what the rules of the game are, because we realize that we've been married for almost 24 years and we really haven't done it right. And we're not quite sure what we're supposed to do next. We're getting excellent guidance, but we're still in the process. So, and we're not living together. So it's really hit me hard hearing you say, you know, you don't stay so small, you know, live your life. Like, it's not just recovery, it's not just step work, it's not just my own personal therapy. Like, where's the marriage?
Can I share? I love this story. I'm sorry, I'm getting too religious. It's throw rocks at me. Rav Noach Weinberg told this story of, he says, Avraham Avinu gets God, comes to him 3 days after his bris thing, and then the three malachim, you know, visit him, you know, and he goes, excuse me, God, I have guests, I'll be right back, you know? That's how Rashi explains, one way that Rashi explains the little thing about Hashem, he says, I can quote the big book, but I can't remember the brochures. Yeah, whatever. So he says to him, you know, God, please don't leave, you know, speaking to God. And then he says to the three visitors, you know, come into my house. So Rav Noach Weinberg says, that's one of the ways that Rashi interprets that, the little thing, the dialogue going on there. Rashi says that's the way God... So Rav Noach Weinberg explained why. Because how can you're in the middle, God comes to you, Vayera Elav Hashem, Belere Mamre, he comes to him, and now there's three guests come. Can you imagine if like a Rosh Hashiva or whoever, a big tzaddikus or a tzaddik that you know, you have tremendous respect for this person, they come to visit you, and you're sitting with them here at the table, and then, somebody knocks at the door, a mishulach knocks at the door, and you go, oh, excuse me, and you go answer the mishulach, and you say, oh, wait a second, I have, you know, a few shkolim here, whatever, and you go, and you come back. It's like a disrespect, you know? God is talking to him. So Rav Noach Weinberg said, no, that's the point. This isn't, if it was a Rosh Hashiva or somebody else, so that's this, you know? Now it's God, the master of the whole world, the creator, and everything is talking to him. Listening to what God wants you to do is more important than talking to God. That's the way he interpreted. So Avraham is sitting there getting a nevuah. Three guests come and he says, God, you understand. Of course I have to go because you want me to bring in guests. That's your will. So he went and he was an Eved Hashem by getting those guests, because listening, doing what God wishes, doing God's will is more important than communicating, than schmoozing with God, you know? That was Rav Noach's take on it. How to apply it, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? But there's a general idea here going on, and that strikes me. When he's calling you, and you hear the phone ringing, and you don't pick up the phone, it's kind of like, I can think about my relationship with my wife, and even feel lots of feelings of love, and this and that, and guess what? You know, she, and not really... has nothing to do with her. It has to do with this image in my mind and my relationship, and I can get all teared up about it and feel this feeling of love. I don't know love if I trip over it. I'm a sexaholic. You know, I really don't. And so what's love? You know, so it's funny, weird thing. Again, I'm going to get religious. I'm really sorry. The Gemara says, V'ahavtas Hashem l'kecha v'chol levavcha v'chol nashcha v'chol meldecha, and the Mishnah goes, I'm learning this Mishnah, I'm in Yeshiva. And I see the Mishnah says all these things. Well, you know, you you do this, you do that, you know, b'shnei yitzarecha when the yitzahara, no, b'chol mida omida, you know, you give tzedakah and this and that. I'm thinking, like, what about loving him? And I went over to one of my rebbe's and I said, it doesn't talk about emotion in this Gemara. It talks about what actions demonstrate love. Why doesn't it talk about it? Isn't there a mitzvah for emotion? Why does the Gemara say that? So the Mefarshim say there is such a thing, fine. But he said to me, because love is action. You know, love is, you behave in this kind of a way. So you, Claire was talking about putting a foot forward. Sometimes acting as if, it's not just as if, it's practicing loving, you know? So how do I practice loving? How do I practice loving? So if I walk over to my wife and I give her a big hug while she's trying to wash the dishes, it doesn't demonstrate love. Now, I think it does. I happen to think it does, okay? And I have had to been. How was I educated in this?
We spent 2 years in therapy on that issue.
Okay. All right. Well, here it is for 20. What is it? 20 shekel everybody's paying to come here. So $5. Here it is for $5. So I'm not putting that down. You accomplished much, much more by connecting through the therapy. That's the time that my wife and I spent doing therapy. Even we had one therapist session we went through about a certain topic once. For like 10 sessions or something, and she would always say, oh, we spent $2,000 or something on this thing, and we got nothing. I'm like, I still can't explain to her yet how wrong I believe she is. The fact that we did that together, that's a bonding there. There's a tremendous benefit to that. So just that itself. So anyway, I don't know if I'd spend $2,000 over it, but anyway. So where in the heck was I?
Giving a hug while washing the dishes.
Giving a hug while washing the dishes.
Someone's got to get wet.
All right. So my image after, excuse me, watching all these porn movies where people are, you know, having sex, you know, in an elevator or something, I don't know, is like, you know, you're not supposed to be doing that here, you know? But now I just want a hug, that's all. And she's washing the dishes. And she's like, you know, you're bothering me, you know? And she wouldn't say it in a mean way. She would say, you know, something like, she probably said something nice, like, can you do that later, or something nice, and to me it was like, you know, it's a tragedy, you know, and we were very upset about that. I want, see, what's going on over here is, I talked about this the other day, when you get on an elevator, two people, you don't stand right next to them, like, here's the elevator, here's one person, you don't go into the elevator and stand over here, you know, and wait for the floor. That's like creepy, you know? So, you know, and it's the same thing. We don't shake hands, you know, for a long, long time, you know, and then like, okay, will you please let go? Even SA guys, you can only hug for a certain amount of time. Afterwards, it's like, can you let go, please? This is weird. I don't want to hug with my wife to last 5 seconds like I do with another guy, you know? There's a boundary there. So, and it goes in grades, and you can touch me on my shoulder. You know, a friend, you know, let's say, you know, Moshe over here can, you know, put, this guy here, can put his hands on my shoulder like this, you know, and I'm okay with that, because we met a few times, you know, I met him a few years ago, we met him, we're buddies, you know what I mean? But a guy here who I never met before, you put your arm on my shoulder, it just feels a little weird. My close friend, you know, can get a little more physically intimate. You know, there's like a little, the boundaries are a little more, just closer boundaries. Guys say to me, a lot of guys have said, two guys I'm thinking of, have said to me, oh, Dove, you know, they're married, they're acting out with some other lady, and they come and they say, but I think she really loves me, you know? Maybe I should leave my wife and go with her. I feel really like I should. I think she really loves me. And I would say to the guy, ask her for the routing number of her checking account, okay? And you'll find out if she loves you. You know, ask her how much money she has in her thing. Find out if it's let's say it's $5,000. Ask her if she'll lend you $5,000, just overnight. Doesn't she trust you? She's letting you go in her. Why shouldn't she let you go in her bank account? What's wrong over here? Because there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 grades of intimacy, And I'm expecting this kind of a demonstration from somebody who I don't even have, I won't even let them know my real name. Look at all these guys I work with. Look at all these guys I work with in recovery on a certain website that I love very much in an interesting way. I really, really do. And they're like, you know, can you imagine one of us getting into this room together and, you know, we have a circle, we're all alcoholics or whatever addicts. And again, like, you know, a guy comes in, sits down in tears, and he goes, "Oy, my life has been so hard. I've been selling everything for alcohol, and I'm just a drunk, and I'm finally realizing that I'm a drunk, and my wife left me, my dog died, and I lost my job, and blah, 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 and my life is hell, and this. I can't stand it anymore, and I see that I'm just destroying myself. I'm finally willing to admit that my name is Tshuva613, and I'm an alcoholic." It's not going to work. The guy's not even bringing himself. You know, the first meeting you, all of you, went to, you wanted to come in with a bag over your head, probably. I know I did. You know, why can't, can I go in another neighborhood where people don't know me and this and that? And why? Because I want to be able to get really intimate and tell people, you know, I want to drive around with my... I'm driving around with my pants down around my knees. That's a little intimate to share. And here I am, not even willing to share my name. There's no intimacy there. There's just like, boom, this explosion of connection that will save me. In recovery, sometimes. That's what Roy meant when he said, we went for the connection that had the magic because it bypassed real union, intimacy and true union. Okay, because it bypassed it. We want to bypass it. So what do we do in marriage? I expect my wife, 100%, I expect my wife to want, excuse me, sex with me all the time. You know, I want her, any not all the time, anytime I want it. And that's not intimacy. That is bypassing intimacy completely for something that I think is going to save me because... In my mind, sex, it doesn't even matter with who, means that you completely accept me and love me and this and that. That's why I pushed, I hope this isn't being over on some, I don't know how explicit you guys get in this room. If I bother somebody, just walk out, you know, whatever. So I'm surprised you haven't walked out already. That's why in the past, major part of my acting out was trying to get my wife to enjoy sex more by looking up aitzes and ideas and this. Every time I hear about some medicine that comes out that increases libido in women, I think, oh, I got to get this for my wife. That's very important. And it's like, no, you know, and it was all my acting out. It was all me acting out, you know. Sexual positions were a giant, giant issue in our marriage. It's a very small issue now. If at all, I'm not even sure if it's been, looking back at it, it hasn't been an issue in a long time. If you would have told me that 5 years ago, I would have scared the crap out of me. Now, it's like, oh, why? Why? Because I don't need it to save me. I'm trying to get her to save me by being outrageous in bed. And if I'm outrageous and you still want to be with me, then I'm okay. You know? It's like Baal Peor, you know? You know, their avoda was like, you know, going to the bathroom on it or something like that. And it was like, in public, if you do these outrageous, crazy things, then that'll push the limit. I have to push the envelope. Why can't I enjoy normal? Oh, no. That doesn't prove anything. People are having sex the normal way all over the place. You have to prove it to me by, you know, let's climb up on the chandelier together, you know? It's crazy. It's really sad. What's the point? The point is that I don't know this. You know? I don't... My wife... When we had a period of abstinence, a voluntary period of abstinence, not the religious one, right? Which doesn't mean that much because if I try to hug my wife when she's anita, she'll slap me across the face. So it's not voluntary at all. That's not abstinence. That's like, you know, it doesn't exist. I'm too ashamed to even try, thank God. The other thing is involuntary abstinence, where she says, "I'm not touching you," which is important because she, or when I feel like, you know, I can't touch you because I feel dishonest. So that's voluntary abstinence, but it's one-sided. And then there's voluntary two-sided abstinence where we both agree. So we had one of those both agreeing things. Nobody needs to be protected from, you know, from the experience. We're both okay with it, but now's not the time for us. We need to. So she went to the mikveh for 4 months with us, and we had to have a thing about what's safe and what's not safe. I knew I couldn't go to bed with her on the first night that she comes home from the mikveh. I couldn't be in the bed with her. I'm going to go out of my mind. But I know this is important for us. So we agreed. We'll sleep in separate beds until we're comfortable. By the fourth month, we were sleeping in the same bed. She comes home from the mikveh. Everything's fine. We had certain, obviously, we couldn't be sexual, obviously. So there were certain boundaries that we established and agreed on. But she says to me, what about this level? What about holding hands? And I said, oh, we hold hands plenty. I'm always the one who wanted to hold hands with her when we went for walks outside. And she was uncomfortable with that. Hold hands in public, are you crazy? But I wanted that. Why? Because I came to see why. Because it's a little weird. If you're willing to do that with me, then that's good. How about holding hands at the kitchen table during dinner? Okay? That I wasn't interested in. Why? How about holding hands sitting on the couch together, you know, listening to music, you know? Why not? That didn't mean anything to me. Why? Why only when we're outside and people can see? Because it's a little taboo-y, you know? So that's what, that proves something to me. So now we hold hands. We hold hands, you know, in places, you know? Normal places. I don't hug her when she's doing the dishes because I don't have to push the limit to prove to her, for her to prove to me how interested physically she is in me, you know? And we also don't need to go to sex right away. It's the same idea. We don't need to go to sex right away. We can, all intimacy doesn't have to lead up to sex. All physical intimacy doesn't always have to lead up to sex because it all has value. Foreplay. It's not foreplay. Technically it is in a way because when we do get sexual, it's partially because we crossed all these good boundaries with each other because they melted. You know, you know what I'm saying? The comfort level, the intimacy level has increased to the point where sex is actually sensible. It's actually normal. Whereas going right to the sex without that, without the intimacy building up, is saying you have to prove to me that I'm okay by doing this. By crossing this, by, you know, exploding with me, you know. That's sexaholism, you know. That's not normal at all. For me, my sponsor pointed out to me that there was a movie, Titanic. He said to me, I would definitely not watch it. It's like a love story thing. But he said to me that in the movie Titanic, this couple... he said to me the scene where there's this old couple and they know that the ship is going down and they go in bed together, an old couple, and they like hug each other and they're drowning, you know, they're going to drown together, you know. And he laughed and he said to me, Dove, if you were in the Titanic stuck with your wife, you would say, quick, let's have sex before we die. Because to you, that's it, you know. And the more I think about it, the more I have to admit to you, I mean, thank God I'm in the program 18 and a half years. My recovery is certainly not anything close to perfect. My steps are certainly like, you know, eh. But things are going okay, one day at a time. And I'm telling you, if I were in the Titanic thing, I might be like that old couple now, thinking, you know, I might be that old couple and I might go down the ship, you know, die holding her. I might do that. But in my mind, I'd be thinking, you know, I really hope she gets sexual, you know, because it's a pity if we don't, you know. So I'm obviously, I have a long way to go. I don't hug her during the dishes because I realize she's doing dishes now. Why do I have to irritate her and put her in a situation to piss her off and have her prove to me how much she wants to be physically intimate with me by not getting pissed off by me bothering her? That's what I'm doing. I'm tempting her. I'm irritating her and challenging her. It's like testing God, sort of, you know? Oh yeah, you know, huh? But you still let me, you know, whatever. It's weird. It's really, really weird. But that's, I mean, what do you expect after all those years? All those years, what does a sexaholic do? Sexaholic has immediate gratification because we go in the bathroom and take care of ourselves on demand, whenever we want to. That's what we discover when we're 15 years old. And we get used to that. Immediate gratification is horrible for development. Patience is destroyed. Somebody said, patience isn't being able to wait, it's what you do while you're waiting. So I'm going crazy while I'm waiting for all kinds of stuff. Forget about sex. For everything, I'm going crazy. You know, so it's, these are, so one time I was at somebody's house, and I knocked on the door, go in, a couple of years ago, and I'm standing there, and they say, okay, I'll get my, you know, I'll get my mother, my father, whatever it was, whoever it was I was waiting for. And I'm standing in the living room with my eyes closed, quiet, standing, breathing. And somebody comes over to me and says, what are you doing? I said, I'm waiting for your mother, father, whatever. And he said, oh, okay, you want to read a book or something? You want to show, she'll be a few more minutes. I go, no, it's okay, I'm practicing being patient. And they looked at me like I'm some kind of weirdo. You know, but that's what it is. When I told you before, I'm okay with two-year-olds. My first son, okay, got it the worst because he changed my wife from a sex object to a baby machine, to a baby factory. Now she's nursing him. Excuse me to say, those parts of her body were no longer for my entertainment. They're for some physical purpose for feeding a child. That was terrible for me. That was tragic loss for me as a young married guy. Horrible. And you telling me I didn't take out that resentment on my infant son? You bet I did. You bet I did. And our relationship is the hardest. The Bechor, Reb Noach sounds like I'm an Asian Torah guy. Reb Noach said, he just had so many great things. He said that the Bechor gets Pishnayim because he gets twice as many mistakes. So for me, boy did he got twice as much resentment. You know, my kids, when I'm not in recovery, my kids, forget it, my kids are pain in the butt number one. Everything's in the way. Get out of my way, you know, I gotta act out. Everything is in, how long will it be until I can get out of the house and act out? Living like that day after day after day makes it, so now what's the process of us growing up? It's gonna be, it's not gonna be coming to here. Let's have healthy sex. Let's work on healthy sex. That's not the way it's gonna happen. It's gonna happen by, let's learn how to hold hands. You know, let's learn how to look into each other's eyes a little bit. Let's learn how to talk about each other and do some active listening. You do that, let's learn how to go to bed together without having sex sometimes. Let's learn how to, you know, whatever. And part of that, and that's hard. That's really hard. It's really, really, really difficult. Let me move on. Anybody else? I talked you to death, didn't I?
It's time.
Oh, okay, people have work. People have places to go to. So, I don't have anything to say. I think that's it. Oh boy. Thank you. I'd like to end with the third step prayer, and I say it a little differently than y'all, but just say it the way you want to say it. And if you don't know it, the ones who know it will help you. My God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you know best. Please relieve me of my bondage to self so that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them bears witness to those I would help of your love, your power, and your way of living. May I do your will always. Thanks for getting together.